morning, everyone. The Subcommittee on Workplace Safety and Respect will come to order. We do have a quorum present. Representative Fenton, did you get a chance to review the minutes?
I have, Madam Chair, and I move the minutes from March 5th.
Representative Fenton moves the minutes. Is there any changes, corrections, comments? Seeing none, all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. The minutes are approved. Today, we're going to do a couple things. First, we're going to hear from a couple of outside experts on harassment policies and procedures. Then we're going to have informational hearings on Representative Hortman's House File 3030 and her proposed amendment to the House rules. And then after that, we will take some public testimony. So with that, we will have Marilyn Clark from Dorsey & Whitney testify first, if she's ready. And then when you get to the table, if you could just state your name for the tape before you begin. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Marilyn Clark, and I'm here from the law firm of Dorsey & Whitney. And I'd like to provide just a little bit of my background and experience to help you understand what I might bring to the table in terms of this discussion. I've been in private practice in labor and employment for 12 years, and in my practice, I have served as an advisor primarily for employers in putting in place policies and practices around harassment and discrimination, and I've also conducted multiple trainings on this subject. As a litigator, I primarily represent employers, but I've also had the somewhat unique experience of representing individuals as well. So I've had an opportunity to look at this issue from both sides. I additionally have served on a regular basis as an investigator, retained by our clients to serve in a neutral capacity to come in and look into allegations of harassment when they arise in the workplace, to serve in a fact-finding capacity and to advise on remedial measures. So having had the opportunity to address this issue from multiple perspectives, from prevention to fact-finding and remediation and dispute resolution, in my experience, the framework for considering this issue from a prevention standpoint must be broader than looking at what the law requires and addressing the issue from a potential liability standpoint. When we look at the legal standards and the potential for liability as the driving factors, there tends to be a reactive response rather than a proactive approach to systemic change. And when we're thinking about implementing policy to make meaningful change over the long term, the Me Too movement exemplifies that once legal issues have actually surfaced, there's a signal that deep-seated cultural issues may exist. So from the policy standpoint, the goal should be to implement meaningful cultural change on a broad level. From that perspective, we need to avoid the tendency to place an import on this subject only in those moments when this topic becomes a hot-button issue. And that's the real crux of the issue in terms of how to structure policy in a way that pushes this issue through on a regular basis such that it becomes part of the culture in an inherent way. And an important part, while strengthening policies is an important step in that process, thinking about the topic of change management and what it means to actually, again, manage this process over the long term. In the private sector, we encourage our clients to think about the consequences of failing to take steps to make that kind of meaningful change happen on a systemic level. And the consequences include reputational harm to the company, the organization, or the institution, distraction from the important business at hand, and the loss of talented individuals who could contribute in a very meaningful way towards achieving those goals of the company, organization, or institution. And there's arguably a heightened import with respect to these potential consequences in government. When we think about the fact that the authority of our elected officials comes from the votes of the constituents in the public, if the body fails to self-regulate in a way that prevents the abuse of that authority, especially in a manner that objectifies others and disrupts the political process, there's the potential for an undermining of the trust that the public has placed in this body. I had an opportunity to review the current code of conduct that's in place that was promulgated in 2007, and the code of conduct recognizes the import of this concern, noting that the use of power and the facilities of the House must be used only to advance the common good. So the $10 million question, of course, is how do you create a culture that promotes that goal? And in my experience, again, working in the private sector, but with a range of employers, both in the context of private companies, institutions, and organizations in the nonprofit sector, I've worked with employers across the range of contexts. And in my view, there are three important components from a policy perspective that employers and organizations need to consider in terms of effecting meaningful change over the long term. The first one is buy-in, that you need to have all of the folks that are involved in the process of ensuring that there is an inclusive and respectful environment bought into the process. And policy can affect this goal by ensuring that there are consequences if those who are part of the body here and are responsible for ensuring that the authority that they've been granted is not abused and the authority of others with whom they work is not abused, that there should be requirements for individuals to come forward to report information that they observe and for there to be consequences if they fail to do so. The second element is encouraging robust reporting by victims. And on this point, I'd like to say just a little bit about the twin cases of Farragher versus Boca Raton and Burlington Industries versus Eller. The Supreme Court looked at the issue 20 years ago of what sort of responsibility and liability employers should have for supervisors or managers within their organizations. And I think there's a good analogy here to the authority that members in the House wield, that when you have somebody who has been granted authority, the organization, the body, should be held responsible for the consequences of the actions of that individual in a strict liability standpoint. In these twin cases, Farragher and Eller, the Supreme Court looked at the issue of a potential affirmative defense for employers, and what the Supreme Court said is that there should be an allocation of responsibility between the employer and employees to ensure that issues of harassment and discrimination are brought forward so that the employer can meaningfully address any issues that might exist. And the concept was that if the employer has no notice or no idea that there's an issue occurring, it has no meaningful opportunity to address that issue. So what the Supreme Court decided was that if the employer exercises reasonable care to prevent and promptly correct any issues of harassment, and if the employee unreasonably fails to take advantage of the preventative and corrective opportunities, then the employer is allowed an affirmative defense. And I raise that the decision in these twin cases just to emphasize the import of adopting a meaningful reporting policy and process that truly does promote victims or individuals who have allegations of potential issues with harassment or discrimination to come forward and to be assured that there is a meaningful process in place to, first of all, dig in and investigate and understand what the scope of the issues are, and second, to ensure there's an appropriate remedial process that follows. And, of course, one of the largest underlying concerns in terms of promoting a robust reporting process is the fear of retaliation. And when we think about disparate power dynamics that exist, this is certainly a concern in the private sector. It's an issue that exists in virtually all workforces. There are even heightened concerns in certain industries and in certain institutions where there are limited opportunities for employee mobility. And certainly government would be one of those areas. So if individuals fear that if they come forward that they might suffer from consequences to their career that could be essentially career-ending, the import of ensuring that policies and procedures have robust consequences for anyone who takes retaliatory action against individuals who comes forward is paramount to ensuring that there is meaningful opportunity for systemic change. Because if the body is not aware of the issues that exist, there's no opportunity to meaningfully remedy what might be occurring out there. And then finally, I wanted to talk a little bit about the investigation process itself. In the private sector, one of the key elements to ensuring that there's a robust investigation process and to ensure that the fear of retaliation isn't something that's going to chill individuals from coming forward with potential concerns is ensuring that there's somebody in a neutral capacity and with expert credentials to participate in that investigation process. If employees and other individuals who believe that they may have been subject to harassing or discriminatory conduct don't feel that there are going to be individuals involved in the investigation process who are going to serve in a neutral capacity, if they feel that there might be bias in that process, that will have a chilling effect as well. You want to ensure also that there is a prompt response, but you want to build in reasonable time to ensure that there is a diligent review. And sometimes what constitutes a diligent review can be something that is a time-consuming process. As an investigator, I have always ensured at the outset that I understand the scope of the witnesses that I need to review, the scope of documents I need to review, and I try to anticipate a meaningful timeline with that initial bit of information. But of course, once you dig in and you start talking to people and reviewing documents, that scope can expand dramatically. So you want to ensure your process isn't so rigid that you don't have time for a meaningful review. Another component of a reasonable investigation process is ensuring confidentiality is protected to the extent reasonably possible, but making clear up front to members, employees, other individuals who might be impacted and who might be considering coming forward, that they can't expect absolute confidentiality, that the body needs to ensure that there is the capacity to share information as needed to get to the bottom of the issue and, of course, to share information as required by law. Finally, in terms of the investigation process itself, investigators should also be prepared to dig in deeper than just the allegations that come forward through the complaint process. And if a complaint has arisen, understand that there may be broader cultural issues involved and be prepared to dig in and get to the bottom of those issues as well. So in addition to building in a process that ensures the individual complainant who comes forward shares the information about their own experience, the investigation process should, as a matter of course, pull in other witnesses, colleagues, other individuals who may have interacted with the alleged harasser, and ensure that there's an opportunity to understand what the broader cultural context is, what the broader cultural issues might be. Then just a final point on reporting channels. Ensuring that there are robust reporting channels, that there are avenues for victims to come forward and share the information in a way provides a comfortable avenue, depending on their individual circumstances, is an important component. I had an opportunity to review the House's current policy, and there are multiple reporting channels available. But one issue that was raised at the meeting that occurred last Monday, I had an opportunity to listen to that session, was the idea of a hotline or a call-in number, And those channels can be very effective in terms of offering an initial starting point for victims who don't feel that they are ready as an initial step to come forward to report to individuals with whom they work on a daily basis, individuals who may, once that information has been divulged, have the capacity to impact their career path. So a hotline number where individuals can report allegations anonymously initially if they choose provides an opening for victims to come forward with information that brings it to the attention of the body and allows the body to start considering what the issues might be. And if it, for a live hotline number, there's the opportunity for individuals who are working that hotline to work with victims and help them gain a level of comfort to come forward, disclose their identity, and share information as they proceed. And then just a final note on the reporting process generally. It's critical to ensure that the process for reporting is not so rigid and formalized that the body fails to have accountability for information that comes to its attention through any reasonable channel. So allowing for reporting via, again, a hotline, via oral reports or oral communication, other means aside from just a formal written process is imperative to ensure, again, that the body is taking responsibility for information that meaningfully comes to its attention through any appropriate channel.
Thank you. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is it Ms. Clark? Is Farragher still good law where if an employee doesn't avail themselves of the procedures available that an employer has an affirmative defense?
Yes.
And
thank you, Representative Portman.
Just to follow up, when you're talking about the hotline, I was just thinking about the affirmative defense that you talked about in Farragher. And I wonder if an anonymous complaint would give an employer enough information to avail themselves of the Farragher affirmative defense. I suppose it would depend upon the circumstances in a particular case. I'm wondering if you have worked with employers who have some sort of an anonymous reporting mechanism that employees can use.
Ms. Clark?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative Portman. That's a very good question. And in terms, if we're thinking just of the affirmative defense, I think we're losing sight of the broader goal and the broader issues here in terms of cultural change. So from an affirmative defense perspective, if somebody brought forward a complaint and reported anonymously and refused to give additional information sufficient to allow for a meaningful investigation, in my view and from the case law that I've reviewed, that would offer the employer a reasonable affirmative defense in that the employee would not have reasonably availed themselves of the reporting processes and investigation procedures available. There are two types of hotlines that generally are used by employers. One would be a hotline where employees can call in and leave messages and provide information anonymously, and there is a team that reviews that information and then follows up and tries to gain what information they can. So if an individual has reported anonymously, named an individual, and provided sufficient facts, then there would be an opportunity for the employer to begin an investigation and dig in. If the individual has left just a high-level complaint, there wouldn't be that sort of path available in terms of an investigation. Manned hotline numbers give the opportunity for a representative of the employer or the organization to communicate directly with the person calling in. And while they might report anonymously initially, having that dialogue and exchange and assuring the individual of the organization's anti-retaliation policies and procedures, helping them understand what the investigation process would entail, giving them a sense of what kind of confidentiality expectations they might have often helps the individual gain a level of comfort to move forward in the process. And it's that entryway into the disclosure of that information that, in my view, is critical. Having a pathway forward for individuals to bring the information to the forefront and then gain some guidance on what next steps might be can be a really meaningful way to ensure that that reporting is encouraged in a way that allows victims to come forward.
Senator Portman.
Thank you. One more question. You know, in our training that was provided by Linda Holstein and in the testimony last week from Sheila Engelmeyer, we heard a discussion about the evolution of the standard in this area, right? So we have legal liability where it might take some pretty extreme conduct and advance notice for an employer to be legally responsible in court for damages. But we have a separate issue about how to create an environment that's free of sexual harassment, which is a standard that's, I would say, higher than what the law currently requires. And I just wondered if you could talk about whether we have seen in any of the cases that have been decided since the Me Too movement started, that is the social standard for what's not okay, starting to impact the court's rulings, or are the courts still relying on a very high standard for severe pervasive conduct?
Ms. Clark.
Madam Chair, that's a very good question. And where the case law will go following the Me Too movement remains to be seen. I think we're still in the thick of things, and it will be interesting to see how case law develops. What I'll say in terms of the difference between the legal standard and what we should expect and hold individuals accountable to within our organizations, within companies, institutions, and organizations are two different things. And if policies and expectations are really geared towards the letter of the law, as I said at the outset here, then we're really missing the boat. And we're also allowing the opportunity for a culture to develop under the surface that by the time a legal issue arises and somebody comes forward and the organization or institution is facing legal liability, there might be a deep-seated cultural issue that then we have to start rooting out. So from a policy perspective, starting somewhere different than what the letter of the law is the best approach in my view, that the body should decide for itself what the expectations are for members and for, especially given, again, the authority that they wield that is afforded to them by the electorate, and ensure that what the expectations are far enough away from what the actual legal standards are in terms of preventative expectations and in terms of inclusion and respectful work environment that we're not allowing what the expectations are to fade into a space where we're only holding people accountable when there's potential legal liability involved. And by ensuring that our policies have that broader expectation, we also have the opportunity to push that expectation through in terms of all of the various ways that we communicate about the work environment. Again, if we're just talking about legal liability, we put the information in a policy and it often then just rests there and resides there until an issue crops up. But if we're talking about culture and the expectations that the organization has, then this becomes part of the regular ongoing discourse. And that's how, in my experience, effective change occurs at a cultural level rather than, again, ensuring that we're just shoring up protections on a from a legal perspective.
Thank you. Other members, I have a question. This was in relation to your comments on the reporting, potentially anonymous reporting. And the one thing that, of course, we need to do as a body is to make sure that there's balance so that the victim has an avenue to come forward and they're not chilled from reporting, and that that there's a process in place and they understand the process and mandatory reporters understand the process. But then there's also the other side of the person accused, and as elected officials, we're not tried in a court. We're tried in the court of public. And so I guess my question is, where does due process fit into this? How does that work? How do we ensure that? So, for example, you know, this is in many different areas, but for an example for the anonymous call-in, how, if someone was accused and they didn't have any information about what the person was or what the complaint was, how are they able to defend themselves? In other words, I guess kind of how do we find balance so that we make sure that both the victim is guaranteed their rights and the accused is guaranteed their rights as well?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a very good question. And again, in my view, the idea of a hotline as an initial entree into the reporting process is an important concept to remember, that information that would come through a hotline channel would not be the end of the inquiry. It's rather the beginning. And if the individual doesn't have information, the accused doesn't have information from the individual who comes forward and reports, the due process, in my experience, would come through the investigation process that would follow. That information coming to the attention of the body is the start of the investigation process, and there would need to be an exploration of the witnesses, the documents, any underlying information that comes out of that report. And the individual who is accused has the opportunity to respond to the information that is uncovered and presented and to defend themselves. And based on the review that I did of the comments that were raised last week during the discussion about the internal process here, and I'll say in advance that I'm certainly not an expert on the processes that are involved here, but the discussion, if I recall, involved some sort of initial step that would occur outside of the public view for an initial analysis and review of the allegations to determine whether there was merit to proceed with an investigation or a process that would be in the public view. And that might be an initial protection that could be built into the process. Before information is disclosed publicly, there needs to be some sort of a due process hearing or a due process step that takes place that might involve an outside investigator, something of that nature. But again, simply because information comes in from an anonymous channel doesn't mean that there's no opportunity to address the allegations. The factual allegations are what will drive the investigation process, and there will be other witnesses, documents, other evidence that will come into play as that process unfolds. And if there is no other evidence aside from just a high-level, unclear allegation, then that would be an example of a situation where there wouldn't be enough to warrant a full investigation on a going-forward basis.
Thank you. And then just in a little bit different direction, what have you seen happen if mandatory reporters fail to report, and what should be the consequences if people that are deemed to be mandatory reporters do not report?
Talking about what the consequences should be in any given situation in this context, of course, depends on the facts and circumstances that exist in any individual situation. But as a general rule, my recommendation in the private employment context is for policies to build in the prospect of disciplinary action for individuals who fail to report, who have an obligation to do so. Also build in the opportunity for potential disciplinary action for individuals who are required to come forward and serve as witnesses who fail to do so or who interfere with the investigation process, and potential disciplinary consequences, of course, for individuals who potentially retaliate as well as individuals who are potential offenders. So in my view, a good policy includes potential disciplinary action against anybody who in any way interferes with the process of investigating or follow up on harassment or discrimination allegations, and ensuring that people understand that it is part of their responsibility as a member to participate in this process and to ensure they're doing their part to uphold the policy. And again, that comes back to the first point that I mentioned initially about how to ensure broader cultural change, that you need buy-in. And sometimes the way to affect buy-in is to ensure that there are consequences if individuals fail to involve themselves in a way that will uphold the values that the body promulgates.
And then just one follow-up question on the hotline. Who would follow up? Because I think now it would, human resources would be the ones that look into these matters currently. So if there were a hotline, would it still be human resources, or who would potentially be the person or the persons to follow up on hotline calls?
Yes, I think human resources would be the appropriate initial starting point.
Any other questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Clark, listening to the discussion today, I just have a follow-up on what the Chair was saying, and that is oftentimes public officials are tried in the court of public opinion versus the court of law. In your experiences, are there boundaries that would be drawn in a situation, and you probably haven't had a lot of situations like a public entity like the legislature, but where there may be, as a citizen legislature, there are members who have other employment, who have other relationships back in their districts and away from the Capitol. Would you envision that those items would be something that we would need to incorporate or should incorporate into this policy that we're considering developing as well?
Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to ensure I understand your question, are you wondering whether actions that occur outside of the legislature in private employment by a member should be part of the internal policies of the House in terms of prohibited conduct?
Representative O'Driscoll?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Clark, I not specifically, I'm just thinking, you know, if you want to put it into two categories, there's your job as a legislator and how you might conduct yourself, and then there's other activities that you might be involved with and how you may conduct yourself. I'm wondering if one set of activities might transcend into from private or away from the Capitol into your duties as a legislator. And do you feel that those things should be a part of the policy that we are undertaking here today?
Ms. Clark?
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's a very interesting question. And in the private sector, the way that issues outside of the scope of employment are dealt with are typically through broader employment agreements between the company and individuals, typically executives who would have roles outside of the organization that might impact how they're viewed as part of the company and might also be viewed to influence how others might perceive their use of authority within the company, again, based on that outside conduct. And employment agreements typically include the potential for consequences if individuals have engaged in any conduct or any activity that includes acts of moral turpitude or unlawful behavior, whether it's inside the company or outside the company, those kinds of activities and conduct that would have consequences on their reputation and by virtue of their relationship with the company, the company's reputation. So certainly in government, there might be the consideration for whether what a member does outside of the legislature impacts how they're going to be perceived within this body and how that might impact their credibility and ability to proceed as a member. Building something like that into a policy is a bit more of a challenge, however, because the opportunity to truly investigate and to follow up on allegations of conduct that occurs outside of this body is limited. So in terms of potentially thinking about what consequences there might be for behavior that occurs outside of an individual's role as a member, that seems like it might be something for a broader discussion within the body. But in terms of an anti-discrimination, anti-harassment policy and how that will operate to try to ensure a positive culture and to ensure there's an opportunity to remedy potential wrongs that occur within the body, it's a bit of a difficult thing to manage and a tough term to incorporate, again, at a policy level.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you. Ms. Clark, just my last idea on this. In your experience with hotlines, as you've referred to them, have you seen the scope of the use of those hotlines in those non-work-related situations where someone may, as I said, you've got the legislative and then all other activities in employment or other experiences, have you had the employment and all other experiences? Have those other experiences utilized hotlines or other services within the employment realm?
Ms. Clark? Thank you, Madam Chair. If we're thinking about robust reporting opportunities, there are a couple of different issues that we need to think of in terms of who might be impacted. So if we're talking about individuals who are not either members or employees of the House that might have experienced discrimination or harassment by a member or an employee, and those might be members of the public, lobbyists, others with whom members or employees come into contact with. I have seen employers use hotline numbers where analog third parties, such as vendors, clients, salespeople, other individuals with whom employees of a company might be interacting, having an opportunity to call in and share information with the company if they've experienced any conduct of that nature. Again, the opportunity to ensure there's adequate follow-up and fully investigate is limited if there is a complaint raised by a third party that is not within the control of or subject to the policies of the company or the organization. But the idea of making sure that there is a robust reporting channel and opportunity to gain information about potential issues, in my view, has merit whether the company has an opportunity to force that individual to participate in the investigation process or not, simply because the organization is then, or company is then made aware of what the issues are and has an opportunity to address potential concerns, again, that might be existing on a cultural level, rather than letting the issue fester by blocking the channels for reporting.
Thank you. Any other questions from members? Thank you, Ms. Clark, for coming forward. And with that, we'll move on to the next witness.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
We'll have testimony from Daniel Prockett from Fagry Baker Daniels. So if you could come forward and then just state your name for the record. Thanks for coming today.
Thank you, Madam Chairperson and members of the subcommittee for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. I commend the subcommittee's commitment to encourage and support a safe work environment for House members, staff, lobbyists, media, and the public. My name is Dan Prockett. I'm a partner with the law firm of Fagry Baker Daniels. I have practiced at Fagry Baker Daniels for more than 15 years, specializing in employment law. And my practice focused specifically on advising employers on legal compliance matters. The early part of my career, I litigated various types of employment matters, including sexual harassment and discrimination lawsuits. And I focused my practice in the last 10-plus years on the preventative side of things, on counseling and advising and training. And I've conducted trainings across the country on sexual harassment and respectful workplace trainings in Minnesota, and I'm also licensed in California as well, and I've conducted trainings in California, Minnesota, and other states. So, again, I appreciate the opportunity to be here today. I agree with much of what Ms. Clark said, and I may step back, and I know there's been multiple people who have testified, so I apologize if there's any overlap, but hopefully some of that overlap also may give you some level of comfort on consistency. First, I don't want to get too deep in the weeds in the law, but I think it's important to briefly discuss where the law draws the line and what we're talking about. Unlawful employment discrimination broadly can fall into three different categories. There's discrimination, there's harassment, and retaliation. And much of the discussions we've talked about are one of those categories with harassment and even a subset within that. So I think to make sure we understand the parameters of where that fits within broader discrimination policies is important. Discrimination really deals with adverse employment actions or differential treatment based on a protected status. Retaliation is where that adverse action occurs based on someone engaging in protected activity, like making a complaint about sexual harassment. And then harassment is a form of basically inappropriate behavior that's based on a protected class. There's generally two categories, quid pro quo and hostile work environment. Quid pro quo means something for something in Latin. That's the sexual favors demanded or some other thing demanded with a threat of retaliation and adverse action if someone doesn't. Hostile work environment is unwelcome or offensive conduct based on protected status. It's severe or pervasive, interferes with an employee's work performance, or creates an intimidating, hostile, or offensive environment. I frame that all up because much of the discussions we're having is really about a subcategory of broad anti-discrimination, anti-retaliation, anti-harassment policies that generally most employers want to have in place, that they are not limited to focusing on just harassment, nor are they limited to focusing just on sexual harassment. And when we talk about that harassment standard and how that plays out in litigation, it is a reasonable person, objective standard that will be looked at based on the frequency of the conduct, the severity of the conduct, whether it was physically threatening or humiliating, and whether the conduct unreasonably interfered with the employee's work performance. And that is a reasonable person objective standard. And I do think that that standard does evolve, and it does evolve over time. And I do think one impact of the Me Too or Time's Up matter certainly may be that courts could look at that objective standard and reasonable standard differently going forward, that there may be more of a reasonable person may tolerate less. It certainly could happen that the courts could go that way. Obviously, courts at the district court and in state courts evolve over time. And harassment can take on many forms, verbal, physical, visual. Certainly verbal and visual in today's world include using technology, whether it's texting or emails to accomplish that. And it can occur anywhere, in the workplace, outside the workplace, at employer-sponsored events, outside of employer-sponsored events, really anywhere. And complaints can also take on many forms, and there's been those discussions about, whether it's a formal grievance that's made, the hotline, and I'll touch on that in a little bit about my thoughts on that. An informal complaint, this is one that can be challenging for employers, that an individual says, well, I want to let the employer know about this, but I don't really want anything done. Or I just want you to know, but I'm concerned if there's any action, so don't take any action. Those are complaints still because someone's raising a concern, and appropriate steps should be taken by the employer, even if the person making the complaint might be saying, but I really don't want you to do anything, and it's a tricky issue. Reporting something that someone witnessed and understanding that that may be a complaint, that if they say, well, I saw something, I wasn't really sure if someone was bothered by it, but it kind of bothered me, that someone expressing a complaint about something they saw and falls into the category of what should be looked at further. Even rumors could be, if there's rumors of inappropriate conduct. And determining at what point an investigation is appropriate is certainly one of the complicated things that managers and HR professionals and private organizations and other employers have to contend with. So I'm going to talk, with that background, I want to talk a little bit about proactive strategies that employers can take to avoid and remedy workplace sexual harassment as well as other respectful workplace issues. I'll start by noting two important observations that I've made through my career. First is the employer's culture from top down is critical. Does the organization truly value creating and maintaining a respectful workplace, including, and I think this is an important one that I've seen with my clients, giving human resources management, both the topic and a person, a seat at the senior leadership table? So when I look at private organizations, some of the ones that have the most issues or most concerns and most problems with potential litigation, not just in sexual harassment, but just employment litigation in general, is one where that human resource professional is either not given, from my perspective, the appropriate weight and influence that they maybe should have because of their level of expertise on what should be done within the organization, that other things are put as a higher priority, where it should be level with some of those other priorities, and also the capacity of the person sometimes may not be at that level. There may be organizations that start as a smaller organization, grow into a larger organization, have broader issues, more states, various more complexities, and do they have the person that has the right training, the right skills to manage the more complicated HR issues, which can include managing investigations into harassment. The second big picture is to have the resources to follow through on the culture. This includes the hiring, developing, and retaining of talent that I mentioned, but also includes creating well-drafted policies and procedures and implementation of those. And obviously, I know that is something that this subcommittee is looking very closely at and why we're here today. So based on those observations, I recommend that to my employers that are considering appropriate responses to the heightened attention that sexual harassment is getting in the sexual harassment in the workplace is getting, is to take kind of two broad categories, and I'm going to break it down into some subparts. One is address the culture. And how do you do that? Well, you can gather and assess information. Consider whether there's any real or perceived workplace culture issues. Consider a workplace climate survey. Those are things that some employers have done. Obviously, it needs to be well-crafted. There's various types of surveys out there. The Harvard Business Journal included one example in its recent January 2018 Big Idea Managing hashtag MeToo publication, which has inputs from a number of different resources. But you have to have a goal in mind before you gather and assess the information. So when I'm talking to private employers, say, if you're going to gather information about potentially looking at what you're doing well or what you need to improve and you want candid feedback from your employees on it, then be prepared to respond and take action based on that information that's learned. The second part of workplace culture, I think, is to promote discussion and buy-in from senior leadership, as I mentioned, to make sure the senior leaders who are in charge of setting the tone are in on the tone that wants to be set, that they're not just saying, well, someone else has told me I need to do this, and or I'm going to give it kind of, you know, it's lip service, but not really bought in. That's really important. And when I talk to private employers about making changes, I'm talking to a VP of HR perhaps at a private employer. I'm saying, well, where's your CEO at? Where's your CFO at? Where's your head of sales at? And we have to make sure that those senior leaders are on the same page if we're looking at changing culture. The next part of addressing culture is consider HR department structure and resources. Again, this goes to having the resources and the structure in place to allow to implement complaint policies and investigation policies to actually follow through with what it is you want to do, to have the resources that are available to do that. And another issue, and again, I don't know how this fits in the legislature in the same way, but it is something that is very much a reality in private employers that we've been talking about, is consider culture and treatment of others as part of the evaluation and compensation structure. I know the compensation structure might not be the same, but when you look at it and say place value on it as a metric against performance, you'll be evaluated about how you're treating coworkers, how you're managing people. Do people feel like you're fostering an environment of respect and input from others? So the second, that's the address workplace culture kind of in the broad category. And the second is review existing policies and procedures. Review the workplace policies, which I know you're doing. Look at those. Determine where there can be improvements made. Make those improvements. Review the complaint and investigation procedures. We've talked some about investigation, and I think in looking at it, looking at the policy, does the overall tone of the policy encourage early reporting and provide easy and comfortable alternatives for discussing concerns before they become complaints? And the hotline option is certainly one that many employers use that Ms. Clark discussed. I think it can be a valuable tool. When I talk to employers, my goal, if I'm trying to help them create an environment that limits risk and limits litigation exposure, which is really what I'm trying to do for my clients on a daily basis, is hopefully you've created a culture where someone doesn't feel, ideally, like they need to resort to an anonymous hotline to make their concerns known and to have them be adequately addressed. So is it an option because not everyone necessarily will feel that, or in certain organizations they're so large that that's difficult, or, frankly, the culture is such that people don't feel that way or have concerns about, can I really openly express a legitimate concern about some behavior to HR, to my manager, have it addressed in an appropriate and professional manner? And if people feel like they work in an environment where that's harder to happen, they will feel like the hotline is more valuable. and more of an opportunity because they're able to still express their concerns and do it in a way that is less threatening to them. Now, again, from my perspective, in an ideal world, that hotline should be rarely used because employees should generally be able to raise those issues outside of a hotline environment if the culture is such that I feel like most work cultures should be. Now, there might be certain things where the particular topic makes that really difficult. The particular people involved make it really difficult, right? Someone that has been harassed by the highest level within the organization, and they know that the HR person will get fired by that person because there isn't culture buy-in at the top, then there absolutely is that mechanism for the hotline. But, again, from my perspective, I hope it's sparsely used by employees of clients. Review training programs. Is your training in-person interactive? So, you know, there's certain – I've done lots of different types of in-person trainings. I've done some in California, which requires supervisors to undergo training every 2 years. And many employers utilize online systems and sort of interactive through a computer interface. But do I certainly feel, and I don't think this is simply because I'm in the room involved, but I think other lawyers that conduct trainings as well, is there more value to having live in-person training where it can be more interactive, whether it's done by professional HR individuals or lawyers? I do think there's value to that. Does your training include discussion of specific fact scenarios that are relevant and relatable to your workplace? This is the stuff around, you know, the gray areas of, you know, is it harassing for two coworkers, one male and one female, to, you know, ask to have lunch together, ask to have dinner together? And you have to have a lot more facts to understand, well, at what point in time does it shift to unwanted? Or does it shift to you're not including someone of another gender because you're just afraid you're going to be accused of harassment? And that's also a very real issue, which also is something that employers need to consider. Again, a culture where there's a presumption of good intentions can certainly help limit those risks. And does your training incorporate bystander training? So this is, you know, there's a lot of people that participate in this work environment that are not employees of the house. You have lobbyists, you have members of the media that can both be victims or perpetrators of harassment. So I'll note that, I'm just going to end by noting that my recommendations that I've identified, I will say, are not necessarily particularly new or insightful. They're recommendations that are, I think, just consistent with best practices. The EEOC's Select Task Force on the Study of Harassment in Workplace, and you know, I'm opposite the EEOC often in charge responses by representing employers. But when we talk about, you know, preventing litigation, I think there's a lot of alignment for what I do and what probably a lot of, you know, plaintiffs, lawyers, those who represent individuals feel, which is demonstrate committed and engaged leadership. That was number one on the EEOC's report. Two, require consistent and demonstrated accountability. Three, issue strong and comprehensive policies. Four, offer trusted and accessible complaint procedures. And five, provide regular interactive training tailored to the organization. And I'll end simply by saying sexual harassment is also just one form of harassment, and we can't lose sight of that when we look at rules and policies. There can be harassment based on national origin, based on disability, based on race, based on sexual orientation. And they're all illegal in the same category under Minnesota law. And so when we look at focusing on policies, although there's a heightened attention to sexual harassment, I think we also have to look at a broader category of respectful workplace and trying to focus on policies that address illegal harassment in all forms. Thank you again for the opportunity to speak. I'm happy to take some questions.
Thank you. Representative Hortman has a question.
Thank you for your testimony. Just one quick addition on the list of categories of protected class statuses. One that you left off was religion, and I think it's important to note that discrimination on the basis of religion is also unlawful.
Mr. Prockett?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That is absolutely true. And there's a long list. Marital status, there is a long list. And you're absolutely right that is another category that I think should be focused, and in the same way, complaints about that form of harassment and how they're addressed should be very consistent with how a complaint of sexual harassment is addressed. And the openness and encouragement to report those complaints about religious-based or race-based or disability or sexual orientation should be the same as encouraging complaints about sexual harassment to the extent those things are occurring.
I have a couple of questions. I've listened to your comments on anonymous tip lines and your view that they should be limited. The thing that I kind of think through, and you heard me ask the other question, was just sort of, you know, we need to balance. We need to make sure that the victims have an avenue for reporting and that they're being protected and they're being heard and they're being, the complaints are being investigated. But also, as legislators, we're often tried in the court of public opinion instead of a court of law. So we need to make sure that there's due process for the accused as well. So how does that kind of work through the process, the confidentiality aspect, and how do you ensure that both sides have their voices heard?
I think when we're talking about the context of a complaint coming through an anonymous tip line or a hotline, exactly how that works can be more challenging depending on the amount of information that's provided in a way that is different than if there is a direct complaint. If there's a direct complaint or concern or however we want to categorize it to a manager or HR, there is then clearly someone who is known to have made the complaint. We know who the person is. And there's an opportunity immediately for some interactive back and forth with that person, that it may be follow-up questions that can happen. That's one of the benefits, I think, frankly, for the organization as a whole, of trying to have that culture where those can occur, because then you can gather information. You can determine who else may have witnessed whatever the behavior may be, who else maybe need to be spoken with, the identity of the person who's responsible for it, and that person can be confronted. In an anonymous hotline, the benefit, of course, is to allow someone an opportunity to make that complaint if they otherwise don't feel comfortable with the various other avenues that have been established. And that certainly is a valuable benefit. But I have dealt with employers who've gotten, you know, complaints without even naming the specific person who was responsible for the behavior. That, you know, someone complains and says the work environment is one that's hostile towards blank, and how to address that can be very challenging for the employer because it can be, and I've had that happen with private employers, of where do we start with trying to investigate this, especially if there's no known other issues, if it's one person who makes the complaint, there's not something tying into, well, we think this is about the complaint we got last week, which was about this person, and it would make sense that they're connected. But sometimes it makes it very difficult. And, you know, the due process, again, in the private employer context, isn't a word that's used in the same way. It's more of, I think, one of fairness and thinking that if there's an investigation, it will be full and fair, complete as it can be, that there will be, you know, confidentiality to the extent it can be protected, but sometimes it can't be. And you try to make the right decision based on all of the facts that can be gathered. And sometimes that right decision is the complaint can't be corroborated, but it doesn't necessarily mean that the person who made the complaint was lying either. It can be. We just can't conclude with a reasonable degree of certainty of exactly what happened. And those are tough decisions to reach sometimes. But it's a long-winded way, I think, of saying the hotline does create some unique challenges for an investigation if the amount of information provided is more limited. And by nature of that report mechanism, it can be more limited than an in-person complaint.
Thank you. And then you heard me ask the question on mandatory reporters, too. What has been your experience for consequences of someone is a mandatory reporter but doesn't report, and what should they be?
Sure. And again, I will say in the context of private employers, the usage of the word of mandatory reporter in a policy would be different than what I'm used to. So we'd look at what does the policy say, and it will all go to the culture. What's the culture that we've created as an employer, and what does the policy language say about someone who witnesses harassment, someone who experiences harassment, someone who receives a complaint of harassment? And that sort of language would be in the policy. And you'd have language that says it's the expectation that it be immediately reported to your whoever it is, you know, immediate supervisor if it's a coworker complaint, or that it be immediately reported to human resources. Failure to report instances of harassment that violates the policy, whether it's a complaint or witnessed, violates the policy itself and, you know, subjects the individual to disciplinary action up to and including termination of employment. That would be very common language in the sorts of policies that we draft. And, again, that's how you create a culture to make sure that you're informing employees if you see something or witness something or hear something that violates our policy, then it should be reported. I think where you might have some gray areas in employees saying, well, I didn't think that that violated the policy, that what I, you know, in the investigation could go into, well, should the employee have made the report? Did what they witnessed, was it reasonable for them to conclude that what they witnessed was joking banter that was not harassing and welcome and wasn't overtly sexual in nature or religious-based connotations, whatever it may be, or was it something that clearly any reasonable person hearing that, witnessing that, should have reported it, and they failed to do so as well?
Yeah, the other gray area we have is that as legislators, we don't have a direct supervisor. Our supervisors are our constituents, so there is no way to discipline them from an employment standpoint directly.
Right, and I recognize that that's a unique difference in this body, but I wanted to at least share how I see it in the private space to the extent that that's helpful as you look at formulating your policies.
Thank you so much. Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as you have asked all of the lawyers that have come to testify about mandatory reporters, and I think we just need to differentiate the concept of mandatory reporters, which are doctors and teachers when they see child abuse, and supervisor liability. So where in an employment context where a supervisor becomes aware of a hostile work environment and fails to take action. And so mandatory reporters, this is a legal term of art that really relates to child abuse. And in the employment discrimination field, you know, we usually talk about supervisor responsibility and employer liability being a sort of a different standard. And then further, I think it's important to differentiate between the standards that an employment policy may put forward and the standards that the law requires. And to keep in mind that the law is very clear on that an employer has a responsibility to take action to correct a hostile work environment with whatever information they have that leads them to believe that there is a hostile work environment. And the law also provides that when somebody comes forward and indicates they have a good faith belief that some harassment has occurred, that they are protected from retaliation. And those responsibilities are regardless of what the policy is. That is what the law requires. So I don't know if you have any comment on that.
Mr. Prockett?
Madam Chair, thank you. I will agree with the points that Representative Hortman is making, that mandatory reporter is something, and I've seen this in the work that I do, the pro bono work that I do, that I equate with, again, people that have a mandatory reporting obligation to report sexual harassment or vulnerable adult, sexual assault of a child or vulnerable adult assault, those sorts of things. And it isn't a term that we use in the private employer space. And I would agree that what we really focus on is going back to the Fair-Gurelert kind of standard and the case law from that of, you know, have we put in reasonable practices to prevent unlawful harassment, unlawful discrimination? And if there is a complaint, do we take reasonable and appropriate steps to try to address that harassment and discrimination in response to it? And you know, supervisors' actions can bind the entity, and so that's what we're largely focusing on is the policies and the supervisor management action in response to either perceived or actual or witnessed unlawful behavior.
Representative Fortman, you make a good point. I think, and from the HR perspective, I was trying to find the list. I think we are listed as mandatory reporters, I think, on the list. And I think there's 51 people listed as mandatory reporters. And I appreciate your point that it's a term of art. I understand that. And that's maybe something that we should look at. But I think we are considered mandatory reporters on the list.
Madam Chair, we are supervisors who can make the entity liable for harassment or discrimination if it is reported to us and we fail to take action. It's the word mandatory reporters that I think doesn't apply. So we're supervisors with supervisory authority to whom people can report complaints, but the policy also requires that we deal with those complaints with the maximum confidentiality possible under the circumstances.
Yep, true. Good point. Thank you. Is there any other questions? Okay, we will move on to Representative Portman, your proposal, House File 3030. If you would like to come forward. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members. So I have two proposals before the committee today, and they both relate to the establishment of a task force. You may recall in the fall that two young women came forward to report situations of inappropriate conduct this fall. One individual reported inappropriate conduct of a DFL senator, and another young woman reported inappropriate conduct of a Republican state House representative, and both of those individuals have since resigned, and we've had special elections. At the time that those young women came forward, one of the issues that they brought to light is that there is not a reporting mechanism for people who don't work here at the legislature. We subsequently found out that there was additional inappropriate conduct by the Republican representative that involved a lobbyist. And the lobbyist really had no mechanism by which to come forward and report what she felt was inappropriate conduct. Because to come forward means that all of a sudden everybody knows who's complaining about whom, and then, you know, will that lobbyist ever get a hearing again in front of that committee or other sympathetic committee chairs' committees. So we clearly had a problem that we needed to address, which is evidenced by the resignation and subsequent special election in two positions in the Minnesota legislature in 2017 and 2018. So in looking at this issue, the young women who came forward suggested that we form a task force, and they sent that request that we form a task force to all of the leaders of the House and the Senate, the leaders of the two major political parties, and to the governor. And the proposal was extremely well-crafted in calling upon employment law professionals and human resources professionals to take a look at our existing system and to determine whether we need to create a new mechanism for people outside the entity, given that two of the three complainants in the fall were people who were not employees of the House or the Senate. I thought it was an eminently reasonable suggestion. It would have cost us nothing. Still, it would cost us nothing. And I think the testimony from the lawyers who have been before this committee so far have shown us that they have a wealth of knowledge and expertise in the field that we simply don't possess. This legislative session, we have 13 weeks, 12 if you take the week out that we're off for Easter. We have a $329 million surplus to figure out what to do with. We have an enormous, complicated issue of federal tax conformity in front of us, the opioid epidemic, the Minlars debacle, and this issue deserves careful thought and attention. And I think that outside professionals have better experience and expertise to do this work than we do, especially in the very limited time that we're here in St. Paul in 2018. My experience is 23 years practicing law. My first few years out of law school is at the Legal Aid Society, where I sued landlords who were accused of racial, sexual, or disability discrimination. Then I went on to work in private firms, including my own, and the Ryder Bennett Law Firm, where I mainly represented individuals who were accused of discrimination, but also represented plaintiffs. And I spent a couple years at the head of a county attorney's office doing employer harassment and discrimination training and defense work. For 10 years, I practiced employment law at a private company where I did the annual trainings on anti-harassment and anti-discrimination. And throughout the 23 years I've been practicing, I've taught several CLEs on harassment and discrimination. And in that experience, I know there is a robust community of professionals in Minnesota who work on these issues day in and day out, and that their expertise and their knowledge would be very helpful to us. They also have the day-to-day practical interaction with these facts on the ground. This is all they do, all day, every day. They represent employers large and small. We feel here at the legislature that we have a unique institution, and we have unique problems with sexual harassment and discrimination, but we're not unlike other entities. We have the media and lobbyists interacting with us. Those are like outside vendors for other companies. And we have our constituents, and those are like other companies' customers. So I don't think that our problems are really that unique, and I think the professional experiences that the human resources professionals in the Twin Cities and the employment law professionals in the Twin Cities have could really inform us. Finally, I think if we had an outside task force, we would get better input from the people who are concerned about our culture, but who are also concerned about retaliation. We know that this committee has asked the lobbying community to testify, and they have politely declined the opportunity to come to this committee and to tell us what's wrong with our culture. And that tells us that something's wrong with our culture. But they might be more willing to talk to lawyers or human resources professionals outside the entity so that we could get that indirect feedback, whether it's reporters who cover us or lobbyists who seek to move legislation through these bodies. I think that if we had a task force of professionals that they could interact with, that we would get more frank and useful input on changes we might be able to make. And, Madam Chair, I have at least two testifiers that I'm aware of, Lindsay Port and Aaron Makewig.
I had Lindsay Port on it, but, yes, they both may come up. Welcome to the committee, and if you could just start by introducing yourself for the record.
My name is Lindsay Port, and I'm here to testify in support of House File 3030. Chairwoman Pepin and committee members, thank you for taking the time to hear this bill, and thank you, Leader Hortman and Representative Makewig and Becker Finn, for authoring it. I also want to thank you for the excellent testimony and discussions that have gone on in previous meetings of this subcommittee. Personally, I am very thankful for the weight and seriousness that you are giving these issues and the thoughtful way you've begun this process. As a candidate for the House in 2015, I was groped by then Representative Dan Schoen. I reported the harassment to a member of leadership who reported it internally. I was told he was disciplined, but since I was not an employee of the House, I was not privy to the details of the investigation or any repercussions. In the course of the following year, I began to hear stories from other women who had also been harassed by Mr. Schoen, as well as other legislators, including several instances after I had reported, making it clear to me that whatever system was set up to deal with this was not effective. In November of 2017, I, along with Representative Mae Quaid and Jamie Becker Finn, went public about this harassment and joined in the national dialogue already in motion about sexual harassment in the workplace. We asked for an independent task force then and continue to believe it will bring forward the best possible outcomes for all parties. As a woman who has gone through the process currently in place, who tried to use the system that has been created by this legislature, I am here to tell you that the current system is woefully inadequate and needs an overhaul. The entire system deserves a thorough look from experts in this field who know the best practices, legal rights and requirements, appropriate privacy protections for the accusers and the accused, and how to build a system that balances all of those needs. Minnesotans deserve to come to the Capitol and interact with our lawmakers without the fear of harassment and should have clearly defined, easily accessible system to report without the fear of repercussions and retaliations, and with the peace of mind that clear parameters for behavior have been set and appropriate discipline has been communicated and will be enforced. No matter if you're a candidate, a lobbyist, a lawmaker, a visitor, a staff member, journalist, or advocate, you should feel safe interacting with our legislators. In the political world, it's often unclear who is responsible for ensuring safe workplaces in different situations. Who is the boss of a legislator, a candidate? What if a member of leadership is the one that's harassed? I don't believe that the harassment that we brought forward and that others reported after us came as a surprise to very many of you sitting here today. Perhaps it felt like the system was the best that could be hoped for in this complex power structure of the Capitol. I'm here to tell you that as a constituent of this legislature, as a Minnesotan, as a mom, I demand better. And since this issue has been given to the subcommittee, I believe that it's your responsibility to ensure that we have the best possible system in place, to advocate on my behalf, and to take seriously our request for an independent task force. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Ms. Poore, for coming forward. Representative Makewade.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, committee. I won't take up too much time because I think what Lindsay said is really important. Having been a candidate when this first happened to me, there isn't that clear reporting structure because there is no boss of a candidate. Oftentimes their campaigns are on their own. It's a gray area. But I also want to say now that being a representative, I see all the ways in which this body uses its own privilege to protect itself. We are exempted from the Data Practices Act. I wasn't privy to the details of the investigation that I was part of from sexual harassment that I experienced. And so I want to make sure that as we are looking at this, the blinders that we often have for ourselves are removed, and the experts who do this every single day can tell us what we should look at to make sure that we are really changing the culture here. And the last thing I'll say is that those who are closest to the problem are closest to the solution, and I hope that the solutions brought forth by people who've experienced this harassment here at the legislature or by candidates is taken really seriously. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Do I have questions from members? I have a few. Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's to the bill author. Representative Portman, on line 2.18 in the duties and report required, it states at number 4, any other issues the task force determines relevant to ensure that the state capitol complex provides a safe and respectful work environment and it continues on. Can you, as the bill author, give me maybe some kind of an idea of what that might be that we didn't enumerate in the bill that we just put in that catch-all category?
Thank you, Representative Portman.
Thank you, Representative O'Driscoll. Well, just to go through Subdivision 2 in its entirety, what the task force would be charged with would be coming up with procedures for reporting, giving us advice on training, coming up with a nonpartisan process for receiving complaints for both us and outsiders. And then any other issues category is to allow those professionals to give us advice on topics that we may need advice on, but we didn't think to put in the request for the task force.
Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Hartman. And the only other question or clarification, I guess, is more than a question. A couple times in your testimony, you indicated that law firms and human resource professionals in the Twin Cities area would be the appropriate people to go to. Are you not planning on including greater Minnesota law firms and attorneys and resource professionals in the task force?
Senator Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative O'Driscoll, I was just speaking to my experience as an attorney practicing in the Twin Cities for 23 years. There is a robust community. Of course, that robust community does exist all over the state of Minnesota. At times when I had to give or receive continuing legal education seminars in other parts of the state, I would say that there is a robust community of employment law professionals and human resources professionals across the state. But I didn't interact with those folks as much as I did my Twin Cities colleagues.
Madam Chair.
Representative O'Driscoll.
Well, thank you for the clarification, Representative Hortman. As a greater Minnesota legislator, I do get a little bit sensitive sometimes when we talk about the Twin Cities in relationship to the rest of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you. Madam Chair,
Representative Hortman.
Representative O'Driscoll, the other thing that I know is that attorneys bill by the hour, and that to the extent that they would give us their time, I guess in my mind, I did picture sort of downtown lawyers who are already very close walking distance in the Skyway to the Minnesota State Bar Association and to their monthly employment law section meetings as being sort of a pre-existing group of professionals for whom it would not be a large inconvenience to add some public service work to the work that they're already doing. But I think to the extent we appoint a task force, we definitely need to think about getting perspective from other places.
Thank you. I do have a couple questions, too. Do you have two more questions? I have a few questions just on the task force itself. How would that work? I'm concerned about transparency. So it doesn't specifically outline in here that I can see, but so would legislators be able to testify in front of this task force? Would members of the public, lobbyists, media, how would we bring transparency to such a task force so that we could see what was going on and that we would potentially be able to participate in the process?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's a good question for House Research on the typical construct that we put on task forces. I have 6 pages of task forces that this legislature has appointed over the years, and they function in a variety of mechanisms, some with very public conversations and some with more private interactions. I think the benefit of having a task force rather than a committee, if the seven of us wanted to get together and talk about what should we do, you know, just kind of bat around some ideas of how could we create a complaint mechanism for members of the media and lobbyists, and how should we deal with constituents who might have complaints, we would have to notice the committee, and we would have to record it, and the public would be here, and there wouldn't be that kind of free give and take. As long as we had a quorum of the committee, we couldn't have any sort of off-the-record discussion, those of us who are on this committee. My understanding is that a task force functions a little bit differently, and there's a little bit more of a casual work environment that's allowed. So there could be more of that kind of casual give and take where somebody has the space to throw out an idea that totally wouldn't work and that in retrospect might look dumb, but they can throw it on the table to get the conversation going. And that's not something we really have a great opportunity to do in this highly formalized committee structure that we have in the House.
So I guess I'm still not clear, though. So I mean, presumably someone would have to give these task force members guidance. So would they be then required to, are you saying that it would be closed to the public and closed to people from testifying, or would it be open, or how, wouldn't we have to lay it out in this bill itself so that the parameters are clear to all involved, or how do you envision that happening?
Oh, well, Madam Chair, I think, again, House Research could give us a perspective of the variety of different ways this has been handled, but I've participated in a number of processes on solid waste management. So the legislature has had an issue brought to it and said, well, we don't have the expertise right now to solve this problem, so we're going to send MPCA and a bunch of industry professionals off to discuss. So whether it's people who are experts in construction demolition or municipal solid waste or waste to energy. And then there were a variety of informal meetings of those professionals who were appointed to the stakeholder groups. I think we had this in the paint industry before we got our paint stewardship bill passed. I know we had the Solid Waste Commission in the 80s that was very, very successful. So I think there are a lot of different ways it can happen. But there are casual interactions that are less available to the public, but still there are opportunities for the public to give input to these groups that we've set up.
So then would the task force itself, I'm still not feeling like there's a clear answer, because I feel like, I mean, this is a very thoughtful proposal, but I feel like we would need to identify what the parameters are, because otherwise it would be the folks on the task force themselves that were deciding whether or not there would be transparency to the public, or whether what meetings would be closed to the public and which meetings weren't open. And I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to work through the process of how that would work, because I think that there could be a lot of room for us to be critiqued in that if we don't have any control over the parameters. You're basically going to have some people in here that don't necessarily have a strong connection to the legislature, that somebody is going to have to guide them into how this process would work and whether or not they should be taking testimony from legislators, from members, from the press, from the public, and unless we're guiding them and telling them. So I feel like if we were to go forward with a proposal, we'd have to be more clear on exactly what the expectations were. I don't think it would be very fair, in other words, to have some employment law attorneys who are a little bit out of their realm in this task force to ask them to decide for themselves. So if you could comment on that, and I don't know, and then Representative Freiberg, you can go after that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, we would get to decide what the parameters of the task force are as the legislature. But what I think I would assume that what the revisers did when I put my request up to the revisor's office is pick the structure that's most common, which is just we appoint the task force, we ask for a report after a certain period of time, and they have considerable freedom in who they talk to and how they conduct their work. Now, we could, of course, identify that we want them to have a certain number of public hearings to take input from the public. But my thinking in supporting the task force proposal is that it's the expertise of these individuals and their ability to have candor with each other that would be so valuable to us. So I trust that if we put together a group of eight people, you know, Speaker Dowd picking two, me picking two, Senator Bach picking two, and Senator Gazelka picking two, that we send those eight professionals off to do some work, that I feel confident that they would give us recommendations that were useful. Now, of course, it's totally up to us of whether we would like to follow the recommendations of task forces. We are a little infamous here at the Minnesota Legislature for creating task forces and asking them to give us recommendations and then not following the recommendations. The ball is ultimately in our court. The question is just how can we put the best information in front of us as legislators to decide what to do going forward? The task force would not have the ability to put into place a complaint mechanism. They could advise to us a complaint mechanism that we could put in place, but ultimately the decision is still ours. Now, I think the concern that I heard expressed by some about forming a task force is the idea of losing control and maybe getting recommendations that we didn't want to follow. That's really a different problem. I mean, there's no risk of a task force making us do something we don't want to do. There is a risk of us getting advice that's good, that the public sees as good, that we don't choose to follow, and then that could be embarrassing. But I don't see that as a reason not to appoint a task force. I think Representative Makewade had a response as well.
Representative Makewade?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative Hortman said this a little bit, but there could be a both and, a yes and, that sometimes this group is meeting not so much in private but themselves to talk about issues, talk about our policies, and then they could also take public testimony. I know that since coming forward, I've had numerous women reach out to me with stories about numerous people at this legislature, and I would love a place for those folks to go tell their stories, but their privacy might also want to be protected as well. So there's a lot of ways that we could do this, but I think that a certain element of having conversations that are not private but not public testimony, and then also having that to be open for public testimony would be good for a task force.
Yeah, and to the point about losing control, I haven't heard that so much as it's just about sort of understanding the parameters and transparency to the public and what we will provide in that. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to go forward with this subcommittee is that they're televised, it's completely open to the public, it's open for members, lobbyists, media, whomever, to come forward. And I'm just concerned a little bit about that if we go forward with the task force, to making sure that that is crystal clear and that we're not sending these, you know, poor eight people out without giving them guidelines and how we want to go forward. So that would be my kind of concern on that front. We do have other member questions, then I have several more myself. I had Representative Fenton on the list first and then Representative Freiberg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at line 1.6, Representative Horton, on the bill. Current members of the legislature, legislative staff, and lobbyists are not eligible for appointment. However, in a lot of the testimony today, we heard about how important it is to really give members of your HR a seat at the table if you really want to change the culture of the work environment. And we do have nonpartisan human resources. My question is, do you want to exclude them from this task force, or would it be beneficial to have a member of our nonpartisan human resources staff on the task force? They often hear more of what's going on around here, you know, that we don't. So would that input be valuable to this task force and to have them be a part of it?
Representative Hortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fenton. I do think that the nonpartisan professional staff have valuable perspective to share, and they could certainly participate in the task force. But I think there is some value to having an independent task force. I think the public has a concern that we're not doing such a hot job of policing ourselves. And to the extent that we create a task force comprised of people who are answerable to the existing leadership structure and don't have independent employment security through some other mechanism, that we might end up getting advice that we've already sort of telegraphed that we would like to get back. And there also could be sort of a perception of a conflict of interest. I mean, our poor human resources staff is buried in this avalanche of issues that have arisen in light of the new culture that's emerging. You know, as an older woman or middle-aged woman in the workforce, you know, I can say things are really, really different. And young women today aren't putting up with things in the workplace that people in my generation put up with for decades. So things are changing, and our human resources department is grappling with the reports that are coming forward here in our legislature and the complicated issues we're having to deal with. I think they have enough on their plate, honestly. I really think we need some outside advice.
Representative Freiberg?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is kind of going to what you were asking about earlier, but I do notice that, on line 2.27 of the bill, it says that the Legislative Coordinating Commission must provide staff assistance to support the work of the task force. You know, I'm looking just at the statutes setting up the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The membership of that commission consists of the Majority Leader of the Senate, the President of the Senate, two senators appointed by the Majority Leader, the Minority Leader of the Senate, one senator appointed by them. Anyway, it goes on. Lots of legislative membership there. And I assume they have kind of a regular process for working through task forces and whatnot and, providing staff assistance to groups like this. I would be interested in hearing, I don't know how this committee is exactly set up. Usually there's a member of House Research at the table. I do see House Research staff in the audience. I don't know if they'd be able to talk about the process that the Legislative Coordinating Commission and their staff uses to advise these task forces, but I assume it's there pretty regularly, and they have a standardized process. And there is oversight. It certainly sounds like there's oversight to the extent we want it in the membership of the LCC.
Thank you. Mr. McCormick, thank you for coming to the table.
Madam Chair, members, when we establish working groups, task forces, actual commissions through the LCC, typically the Director Greg Huminger sits down with both the House and Senate nonpartisan staff and with his own staff, and we create a working group of staff. And everything from the typical work that a committee administrator would do in setting up the meetings to the expertise and various kinds of legal and policy analysis that are needed are done at the staff level. So for a task force like this, we would probably consult with Mr. Huminger would put together personnel officers from House and Senate, probably some of our legal staff, and we would sit down with the 8 appointees and attempt to create a structure for hearings and meetings and for ask them what they wanted to do and how they were going to implement the charge that the legislation or the work would do, and just basically put together a schedule. My general advice is that this continuum from what I call a working group, which can just be a group of people sitting in a room putting together their ideas on legislation or on policy, all the way to a full commission, is something that needs a lot of thought at each step about some of the protections of our regular legislative process. So what we would probably do with a group like this is urge them to meet in public and to make recordings and to be accessible, because what they're doing is trying to interface between the public and their concerns and the members and their concerns, and that's something that usually benefits from a more formal structure. But once again, we would talk to whoever was appointed and to the people and try to put together a work plan, review that with all 4 caucus directors and sort of try to get buy-in in advance so that what came out the back end represented something that everybody at least understood the process. And the other thing I would note is that on something like this, Representative Hartman's dead right, there's nothing that is here that is not advisory. And in fact, it's not this legislature that would be dealing with this. It's the next legislature after the next election. By having the right experts, the right legal advisors at the table, we can at least avoid some of the pitfalls that a number of these task forces get into, which is not understanding the legislative process or the lawmaking process. And that would be one of the goals that we would bring to the table, is to try to help integrate the outside experts with some of the internal process. And I worked on dozens of these, and some of them were great, and some of them didn't work very well.
Jeff Feld? So, Mr. McCormick, as long as you're here, so to my earlier questions, since it doesn't specifically say exactly, it doesn't kind of address the topic of if these meetings would be public, if there would be transparency required,
Would then, under your reading of this or under the comments you just made, would then that be determined by the members of the LCC, or that would that be determined by the leaders that are defined in here, or would it be determined by the staff person in consultation with the eight people that are actually on the task force? Who would decide exactly the schedule of whether they're, you know, we're going to take public testimony, if legislators can testify, if it's open to the public, if they can talk to the media, things like that?
Madam Chair, members, we would probably talk to the authors, we'd talk to all four caucus directors, and we would talk to the members of the LCC and ask what their expectations are. I can tell you up front that my advice would be that we do as much in public as possible and that we avoid situations where major policies are being drafted in back rooms of the legislature, and instead that we should default to public hearings and we should default to public discussion. It doesn't mean that staff and that these people can't put together ideas behind the scenes and bring them to the public hearings. A lot of work goes on. When I draft a bill, it's happening in my office and to me and the author. But in this case, I think that we want these things to alight as soon as possible in public.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hortman.
Mr. McCormick, I wonder if not here, but after the committee, if you could give us an example of a work group that was successful, a task force that was successful, and a commission that was successful. So we could look at sort of the legislative construct that was put together that enabled a successful group. I know that this is a kind of a bare-bones bill draft, and that when we actually seriously intend to move legislation forward and form a task force, we deal with the issues of whether they'll be compensated and all those details. I know this is an informational hearing. I don't know if it's the chair's intent to ever move the bill out of the Rules Committee or if it's here to die a quiet death after this informational hearing. But if we were to actually move the bill forward, I think we would want to look at the legislation that put into place other successful efforts.
Representative Freiberg, was this still on the same topic? Yep, go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess the question's for Mr. McCormick. It's just you said your general recommendation was that the meetings be public, particularly given the charge to this task force, it seems like it would be dealing with potentially sensitive, potentially confidential facts relating to issues of sexual harassment that may have happened to lobbyists or staff or members. And there might be circumstances under which, you know, maybe their default rule might be to have their meetings be public, but there might be circumstances under which they'd want to take testimony in a setting that's not public. This past Friday, there was a report that came out dealing with one of the situations that led to this whole discussion and the creation of this committee. But the details of that report were not made public. And I'm not criticizing that decision. There's certainly probably very serious privacy concerns that arise with that. But do you think, in this sort of situation where you're dealing with these, might it be better to have a bill drafted with some flexibility to allow for situations where there might be somebody who's not comfortable coming forward in a public environment?
Mr. McCormick?
I'm sure we're just chatting with some of the personnel attorneys behind me. If it's a kind of a question as to whether this group would take testimony from victims, people with actual complaints, and if they did that, you're right. They should probably consider procedures that would allow those to be taken in private, because privacy is one of the cornerstone concerns. If they're not taking that kind of testimony, if they're taking testimony more generically about how organizations deal with issues of discrimination and harassment, then they don't have to do that in public. And I think that's something where if this was appointed, you'd talk to the appointees, you'd try to gather a scoping statement that determined whether that testimony would be part of the work plan. And if it was, I think we'd probably put together an opportunity for private testimony.
Thank you. And then I had another question, and I'm not sure if this is for you, Representative Hortman, or you, Mr. McCormick, but maybe both. What do you envision for the media, since this has been, as you know, you and I and others have had multiple media requests on the issue. So how would that work with handling the media? Would the chairperson of the task force be the spokesperson for the group, or how do you envision that? And then maybe, Mr. McCormick, if I'm not sure if other task forces, like Task Force on
solid waste. It gets the same amount of media attention, but how would it potentially be, or how has it been handled in the past?
I can tell you, Madam Chair, that Pat Kessler never called me the whole time I was going to those solid waste task force meetings. I hadn't envisioned what we would direct the task force on dealing with the media. We certainly could put in the legislation. Again, I know this is an informational hearing, and so we're having a fairly hypothetical discussion here about what we would do if we were serious about moving this bill. But if we were serious about moving this bill, we could certainly put something in there that we would like the task force to be able to take confidential input from, you know, lobbyists and media who aren't so willing to sit on this testifying table and give input to us, and we could request that they keep that information confidential. But, you know, I don't know how in the weeds we want to get about what parameters we're going to give to a task force that sounds like is never going to exist.
Well, I would just say, I mean, we'll hopefully listen to all sorts of proposals and public testimony, and then hopefully we can bipartisanly. Ann Lincheski would kill me.
Rachel
Stassenberger would kill me. So hopefully in a bipartisan way we can come up with some recommendations. Did you have a comment on that, Mr. McCormick, if that had been an issue in the past, or maybe the other task forces haven't been quite as high profile?
Probably the highest profile a task force I've worked on was the 35W bridge collapse investigation. And in that situation, we worked with a firm with who we hired, and we basically told them we did not want them to go to the press until they had completed the report and controlled their conversations with the press more firmly. Outside experts don't work for us, and in outside expertise, we can ask them to be confidential. We can put something in a potential law, but they don't work for us, and so we have to be a little bit more careful about how we deal with our private data for someone who doesn't work with us. But that's something you could work out if, depending on how this was structured.
Yeah, I'm just trying to kind of work through it. And I was looking at that line as well, the LCC must provide staff assistance, and you kind of touched on this, that we'd have to kind of figure out what the per diem and mileage if we go forward and how that would work. But it looks like, I'm assuming just kind of how it's written now, it would be a house employee potentially that is staffing this that we would have to apparently write the report. So my question is, I've heard several times of, you know, we're the problem and so we need to have outside experts because we're in the fishbowl. And that does make some sense. I fully understand that. But at some point, if we were to take any of these policies, we would have to presumably vote on them here anyway, just as we're going to have to vote any policies we put forward that come out that we recommend to the full rules committee and then, you know, potentially to the rest of the body. So if you could just comment on that a little bit.
Yes, Madam Chair, I would not at all picture staff of the House or the Senate writing the report. I would picture the task force writing the report. I think the critical element here is getting the expertise of the outsiders to inform us. And I think that they would best be the people to do that work. But I'll make a commitment to you that if we have a real hearing on this bill where we're going to have a vote where we talk about moving it through the process, that I will have in hand examples of the legislation that has pre-existed successful work groups in the past, and we can work through those issues. Given that this was an informational hearing and we're not actually talking about moving the bill today, I didn't do that research. It was my pretty clear understanding from the Speaker, the Majority Leader in the Senate, the Minority Leader in the Senate, that there was not yet a bipartisan interest in moving this process forward. But if you would like to have a hearing on the bill and a vote on the bill, then we can work on putting these details together. I would really love to work with you on putting a serious proposal together that might get bipartisan support from the leadership of the House and the Senate.
Hopefully we'll put together some policies or procedures that make this a better and safer workplace. So, well, thank you. Is there any more questions on this bill? And then, Representative Fortman, you also have the rules change proposal. Did you want to go through that as well?
Thank you, Madam Speaker, or Madam, interesting flip of the tongue there, huh? Madam Chair, it's really the same rationale and the same proposal. Just if we did it through House rules, then we don't need those pesky senators to agree with us on whether to do it or not do it. It would just be a matter of the minority and the majority agreeing together that we're going to do this. And the proposed timeline in there, of course, we would have to move. And again, I understood this to be an informational hearing on the rules change as well, so not that we're voting on this today. But if we were going to seriously discuss amending the rules to create this task force, I think that, you know, we'd have to adjust the dates for sure.
Yeah, Representative Portman, since these, I mean, you know, they're supposedly permanent rules until the next, you know, rules committee, and this is only the task force you're looking at just for a short period of time, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, I don't think I have any additional questions. Does anybody else have any questions?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. Okay. As I mentioned earlier and in our previous meetings, we want to make sure that we have opportunities for members of the public, and we will have, I think next week, is it next week that we have the evening session? Next Tuesday, we'll have an evening session, but no, it's next Tuesday. So that way we'd have people that could come during the day, and we thought if people couldn't come during the workday, that they'd be able to come during the night. But we do have some people here today. Carolyn Palmer and Terry Walker McLaughlin are here to testify. So if they could please come forward and give us their thoughts, we'd really appreciate it. Thank you for coming. We really appreciate hearing your perspective. And then before you begin, if you could just introduce yourself so we have it on record.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee or subcommittee. My name is Terry Walker McLaughlin. I'm with the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, also known as MNCASA. MNCASA represents 70 sexual assault victim service programs statewide. We work to improve the cultural and system response to sexual violence. We know that sexual violence affects everyone, not just here at the Capitol, where the focus currently is on sexual harassment in the workplace, but in any setting. We offer today our enthusiastic support of the Advisory Task Force on Sexual Harassment to the State Capitol. We eagerly await the opportunity to work with the legislature to develop the best possible approach to preventing and responding to reports of sexual harassment. Following the Me Too movement exploding last fall, the whole country's been paying attention to what our leaders are and will be doing in response to disclosures of sexual harassment in the workplace. At MNCASA, we offer a state and nationwide perspective on the need for this change. Minnesota is not alone in the need nor desire to take a positive action. Similar conversations are taking place across most states across the country. And in response to this need, fellow coalition directors from across the country have been working together to provide information and expert assistance to our respective lawmakers in how we most effectively make our workplaces safer for all. We've each contributed in creating a basic curriculum package designed to be enhanced, adapted, customized to each audience and its individual needs. Nationally and locally, our priority has been an effective response must be victim-centered. It must be confidential, as was spoken to extensively today, and it must be accountable. We realize that a broad cultural shift of this magnitude will not happen overnight. It may take some time, and we're here for the long run to see this through. We're committed to working with all the lawmakers, staff, lobbyists, and the public to improve the response here at the Capitol. And finally, at MNCASA, we say we all know someone. That someone could be a colleague, a friend, family member, ourselves. We join with you in standing strong for all of the someones we know. I'd welcome questions at this point.
Questions? Representative Portman.
Thank you. You mentioned a basic curriculum package. Could you just talk a little bit more about that,
Ms. Walker-McLaughlin?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative. The coalition directors meet and discuss issues on a nation, on a national basis regularly. One of the things of discussion recently, as you might imagine, has been the Me Too movement and the concerns with state government, state legislatures, with regard to how we can best address the work within our home states. Many state legislatures have gone to their coalition and said, please help us define a curriculum that serves the purpose that you speak to so often. That being, it must be victim-centered, it must take into account various marginalized communities and serve all of the peoples that we work with. This discussion started last November and has been continuing. We gathered together in December over several conferences and started to develop a curriculum. That base package of curriculum, the instructions, the PowerPoint, and the discussion around that has just been released to all of the coalitions. We're going to continue to be working on this, but it's ready to go and at least be delivered or considered for amendment and inclusion in practices that the various states may take on.
Senator Portman?
Thank you. So it's like training for legislators or in training for the executive branch on anti-harassment, anti-discrimination?
Yes, it is. And it can be specifically adapted for that. It can also be adapted for other environments as well. That's the design, to make it serve the community that it's focused on, just like was spoken to the critical need for that earlier.
Thank you.
I would now like to introduce, Madam Chair, my colleague, Caroline Palmer. Caroline is our public and legal affairs professional manager. Caroline?
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer. As you heard, I'm the public and legal affairs manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I want to thank everyone here for taking such a strong interest in working to address sexual harassment in the House. I'd also like to take this opportunity to just comment a little bit on some of the proposals, as well as give you some additional context with conversations that are going on around the country. And I think as we've all heard in all of these meetings, and especially from some of the attorneys who were speaking earlier, there is great complexity in this process as you're balancing victim rights as well as due process rights, and we fully appreciate how complex this conversation is. I did note a few weeks ago that you heard from the National Conference on State Legislatures, and I think they do have a very good start on a comprehensive list of recommendations for policies and trainings, and these are points that we have been talking about with our sister coalitions around the country, and I think that is a good resource. I also wanted to highlight the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission report, which we actually provided to the committee today. This is a report that the EEOC put into place with the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, which is located on the East Coast. And that is our major resource for all of the state coalitions. And we thought this might be a helpful tool as you're continuing to walk through your process. One of the things that it points out, and I think some of the earlier testifiers pointed out too as well, is the great importance of doing a survey of your climate and understanding the sort of workplace and what key issues are that people are concerned about. And, of course, it's an anonymous survey. At MnCASA, we work quite a bit with system change in different disciplines across our communities. We do sexual assault response teams that bring together law enforcement, attorneys, and other folks who are in the system response. And one of the first things they do is a needs assessment to understand what they're dealing with in their communities. They then set up protocols and processes, then they evaluate it, and then they start all over again. It really is a circular process. So we're hoping that's something you might consider building into the work that you do here. I think everybody has touched on pretty well the concerns about training, and it's all about culture change.
We know that you can have very excellent trainings on avoiding, you know, liability, how to set up a process. But culture change is really the biggest part of this. And the EEOC report that I provided actually provides a pretty extensive section on talking about how to integrate that into the work. With regard to the task force proposals that we're seeing come forward, just a couple of key things I wanted to note. I think it's definitely understandable about not having lobbyists involved in the process. However, some of the victim advocacy organizations, such as MnCASA and others, are lobbyists on our staff. And so we just wanted to be clear, if you are considering lobbyists, just the lobbyists themselves who work for these organizations or the organizations as a whole, because we definitely want to be a resource to you as you work through this process. With regard to victim privacy and confidentiality, again, great conversation about that today. Within the statutes, and certainly this is in the context of the judicial branch, but I think it's worth noting here as well, there are privilege statutes under 595.02 subdivision K for sexual assault advocates and the clients that they work with. And so we would want to make sure as the conversation continues that those privilege issues are addressed and noted as to how they would be looked at in this particular process. And then finally, I think I've heard also from the committee today a great deal of commitment for ongoing work beyond task forces. And again, culture change takes a very long time. And we definitely appreciate all of the commitment here to looking at these complex issues and stand ready to help in any way we can. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Any questions from members? Well, thank you so much for coming today. We really appreciate it, and look forward to getting any additional resources that you may have.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay, members, so again, we'll be meeting next Tuesday, March 20th. Oh, yes, is there any other public testimony today? I should leave. We do have some time if there is other public testimony. Thank you. Okay, so we will be meeting next Tuesday, March 20th at 5 p.m. in this room, Capitol Room 120. And we'll go over potentially some policy recommendations by our House research, in addition to an opportunity for more public testimony for folks that aren't able to make it during the day. So any other questions?
So no meeting next Monday morning?
No. Having it Tuesday instead, we wanted to make sure that members have an opportunity to get here and members of the public as well. Representative Schultz?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is this document on the committee's website? Could we put it there?
Yep, we'll do that. Thank you. All right, seeing no other questions, meeting is